This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If someone is going to make a joke about a college major, art history is usually the first target. But art history can be an important look at the social and political history of an era, and that was never more evident than the Renaissance.
I mean, Michelangelo believes in the Republic and, you know, identifies with Florence, but Leonardo really preferred courts. He was wonderful in a court. He was great wit and raconteur.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll take a look at the history of that historically creative time through the lens of two of its giants, Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo. And we'll spend an academic minute with another cultural giant, Doctor Who. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The new book, The Lost Battles, Leonardo, Michelangelo, and the Artistic Duel That Defined the Renaissance, tells the story of the competition between two of the greatest minds of the Renaissance, Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, as each are commissioned to paint frescoes in the Great Council Hall. Renowned art critic Jonathan Jones brings Renaissance Florence to life in a portrait of the artists and their work. We learn the background behind the creation of Leonardo's Mona Lisa and Michelangelo's David. It was a time when art and politics went hand in hand. Jones shows us how Leonardo and Michelangelo each used their art to advocate their beliefs on the nature of war and their vision for the city of Florence. The Best of Our Knowledge is Joe Donahue spoke with Jonathan Jones about why he chose to explore these two men and this competition.
Well, to the two men, they're the greatest artists in history. I think I defer to the common opinion on that. I mean, it's my own sort of passionate belief as well. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci has been my favourite artist since I was a child, really, you know, first sort of encountered his work. And Michelangelo, very close in my in my heart. The story, I'm an art critic on the British newspaper, The Guardian, and at some point I came across this story. I was writing features and things, and some of which are about art history, and I came across this story in Vasari's Lives of the Artists, you know, which is a wonderful book written in the 16th century, which is full of incident and brings art to life. It was, you know, written 500 years ago, and I came across this idea that, you know, story that Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo actually had a competition, that they were put in competition to paint a room in Florence, and, you know, that they went head to head. And I'd never even, for some reason, although I'd loved these artists all my life, I'd never really quite realised even how contemporary they were to each other. I mean, Leonardo was about 25 years older than Michelangelo, but nevertheless, they were both Florentine citizens. They were both educated in the workshops of Florence, apprenticed to great Florentine artists of the previous generation, and, you know, had the same kind of, really had the same, very similar education and everything. And both of them also went away from Florence. Michelangelo, even when he was quite young, went to Rome. Leonardo spent a lot of his working life in Milan. And for that reason, they never bumped into each other. you know, they were both, they never, their paths never crossed until the start of the 16th century. There'd been a revolution in Florence. The Medici family, who, you know, we all think of Florence and the Medici, but the Medici had actually been thrown out of Florence by a revolution. There was a republic in which Niccolo Machiavelli, of all people, the man who wrote The Prince, the most, you know, controversial political thinker of all time, Niccolo Machiavelli was actually a prominent figure in the republican government. And at that time, Leonardo and Michelangelo both come back to Florence, and they are both working in the early 1500s on extraordinary things. Leonardo da Vinci, in order to, as a kind of calling card, to sort of impress, to remind Florence who he was after he'd been away for a long time, to absolutely win the city's heart, actually started painting a portrait of a citizen's wife, a merchant's wife, which is the Mona Lisa. And it was begun, we know, it's now known, you know, there is documentary proof that it was begun in Florence in 1503. And at that same time, Michelangelo was at work in the cathedral workshops carving a huge damaged block of marble into David. So the Mona Lisa and David were both produced in this small city, but 60,000 people in it. At the same time, by two artists who knew each other, and actually they seem to have come to hate each other. Because of that, because you have, you know, Leonardo's there, he's working on the Mona Lisa, Michelangelo's working on David, they're, boom, explosive thing. And it occurs to the government of Florence, the Republican government of Florence, in which Niccolo Machiavelli is a very important civil servant, it occurs to them to put the two artists into an actual head-to-head competition to both paint battle paintings, huge wall paintings, frescoes, in the Great Council Hall, which had recently been built, which was specially created as the meeting place of this republic. So, I mean, I was just absolutely entranced and fascinated by this story, and I wanted to bring it to life and not just to sort of rely on Vasari or something, but to actually go to the contemporary documents and really, you know, see what it was really like.
You point out in the book that the battle paintings of both Michelangelo and Leonardo were commissioned for political reasons and, as the title suggests, were lost for political reasons.
That's right, yes. I mean, there's, of course, Leonardo's picture was called the Battle of Anghiari. I mean, they both painted battle scenes. That's why the book is called The Lost Battles, because, you know, this was a patriotic thing. It was to do with, you know, the government, the government hall. So, you know, these were great Florentine victories. But Leonardo's Battle of Anghiari, there is a lot of fascination in whether it might survive under the later pictures in that wall. But both works were lost. They were never finished anyway. And what was finished was the full site. A lot of it was just destroyed. And then there's an ambiguity about whether Leonardo's unfinished wall painting may be hidden inside a wall. The reason was because it wasn't absolutely, what I try to do in the book is to really, I mean, I find Florence the most beautiful, captivating place on earth, basically. I mean, it's a place of great beauty, and so much of it is well preserved. You know, you can stand on a hill above Florence and see the skyline in the twilight, and it's very much the skyline that it was then in the 1500s. And yet what we miss, what has been lost, is the political violence, the violence of everyday life, the intensity and, you know, sort of medieval quality of the world in which these artists actually lived. Florence was a very turbulent place. That's really what Machiavelli's writings are about. His writings are about a city, a republic, which is always divided into factions, and they're always fighting one another. The Medici are thrown out in 1494, and then they violently come back and take the city back in 1512, which is the moment at which kind of this competition becomes, you know, gets kind of erased. And this is why these battles are lost, because they're caught up in, you know, political commissions that are caught up in basically a series of sort of revolutions and civil wars, which culminates in 1529. Michelangelo was back in Florence. Leonardo was dead by that time, but Michelangelo had done these idealistic works in his youth for the Florentine Republic. David was seen as a symbol of the Republic. It's David standing up to Goliath. Goliath, for them, represents tyranny, and David is the people standing up to tyranny. And then he did Michelangelo. His design for the Great Council Hall competition was the Battle of Cascina, which was, again, he put all kinds of Republican idealism into it. It's very like David. It's a nude army, actually, an army of nudes jumping out of a river, but they're showing their readiness. They're young men who are ready to fight for their city. So it was all very idealistic. But in 1529, the Medici had again been thrown out. There was a siege, a huge army sent by the Habsburg Empire on behalf of the Medici family, came to Florence, surrounded Florence, you know, and Michelangelo was inside the city. He was the commander of fortifications for the Republic. So all his youthful idealism, he didn't lose it when he got older. In fact, he, you know, it's the bravest thing he ever did, and he was a very brave man, but the bravest thing he ever did was to be the commander of fortifications for the Florentine Republic in its last stand in 1529, in what was actually a doomed struggle, and Michelangelo was lucky to get away with his life. A lot of people lost their lives. It was a gory event. And after that, he exiled himself from Florence, because after that, the Medici really took over Florence and became dukes, and Michelangelo didn't want any part of it. He left in 1534, to live in Rome, and of course he worked on St. Peter's and in Rome, but he never returned to Florence. He lived another 30 years and never returned. He made himself a political exile. So that's how sort of serious he was about politics. That's one of the things I found out in the book, that, you know, Michelangelo is a deeply political man. And Leonardo da Vinci was very different. Leonardo, he never expressed a political view that we would recognise as such. And he liked courts. Michelangelo believes in the Republic and, you know, identifies with Florence, but Leonardo really preferred courts. He was wonderful in a court. He was great wit and raconteur, and his inventions, of course, all the science and inventions which fascinate us today, a lot of it was to entertain people at the court. You know, he would, there's the thing in his notebooks where he invents an armored car, or a tank, actually, made of wood. It's one of his most famous inventions. But what's less well known is that he, on the notes, he says, well, this would be good in battle, you know, like it'd be like the elephants that Hannibal used. But also he says it's excellent for jousting. So you have this image of knights jousting in armored cars, in wooden tanks, which is a sort of science fiction image. But, you know, that's the kind of thing he was doing a lot of the time, was entertaining people at court. But he was also a military engineer, as I say, designed a tank. He worked in real battle situations, war situations, as a military engineer. And he'd done that for a long time by the time he painted the Battle of Anghiari. And the Battle of Anghiari is sort of, he puts that experience, what he had learned of war, into this very disillusioned, actually horrific painting, which I see as the first anti-war painting. It anticipates Picasso's Guernica. It's a savage, vicious, visceral image of the irrationality of conflict, the sort of the primitive passions at the heart of battle. There's images of cannibalism in it. The horses are biting one another, and the men have these kind of frenzied masks of faces as they hack at each other with their swords. It was a terrifying picture, and it was a denunciation, really, of the barbarity of war.
Still to come, Joe Donahue continues his conversation with art critic Jonathan Jones about his book, The Lost Battles, Leonardo, Michelangelo, and the Artistic Duel That Defined the Renaissance. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1183. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Jonathan Jones, a renowned art critic and the author of the new book, The Lost Battles, Leonardo, Michelangelo, and the Artistic Duel That Defined the Renaissance. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
You write in the book that competition was at the heart of Renaissance art, but you go on and look at this idea of competition and how from Picasso and Matisse and how it has evolved through time of how this artistic competition is very much alive today.
When I was writing the book, I was actually on the jury of the Turner Prize in Britain, which is, you know, very sort of I don't know what the word is, but controversial sometimes, but it's a competition for contemporary artists. People like Damien Hirst have won it. And it was funny in a way because I was kind of going between the very late, very newest art and some of the older art. And yes, obviously in the 20th century you had Picasso and Matisse very much preoccupied with rivalry with one another. You can go through a bit, although the book, the book is very much about these two artists and their world. And I think competition in the Renaissance was very specific. The Renaissance was a kind of, they had a sense of evolving, of progressing. Leonardo da Vinci says a very revealing thing. He says that in his notebooks, it's a sad pupil who does not outstrip his master. that in The Apprentice, you know, you're apprenticed to an artist, but the idea is not to be like them. The idea is to be better than them. And this was very real in Renaissance Florence. You know, every generation at that time was better than the last because they were discovering fundamental things, you know, how to draw in perspective, how to give depth to figures. And, you know, it got better and better and better. And you can see it, that, you know, their mastery of technical skills was actually improving every decade. So, and by the time you get to Leonardo and Michelangelo, this culture of always trying to be better than the last person had gone on for a long time, really. And they're at the zenith of it. The problem for the Italian Renaissance, actually, was what happened was about to begin. In a way, this competition, I mean, the Lost Battles is a sort of, if there's a sort of almost a melancholy in that title, it's partly because this competition is almost the zenith of the Renaissance. I mean, it was mad to put Leonardo and Michelangelo in competition with each other. There wasn't any way to evolve beyond them in terms of technical ability. If the Renaissance was about learning, you know, becoming more and more skilled, these guys were just, and no one, let's face it, what artists since? I mean, you know, we're talking about 500 years ago, but you can put other artists in the same league as Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, but I don't think you can ever say any artist has ever been better than them, or ever, you know, probably ever will be. I mean, they were sort of perfect, and that was a terrible problem for Italy, for Italian art afterwards. You know, it was shattered by, after this period, you know, of course you get Michelangelo goes on from this to do the Sistine Chapel, and there's young Raphael, who is actually a witness to this competition, was deeply influenced by it. So he was there watching them doing their competitive works, learning from both of them. So Michelangelo and Raphael then go on to decorate Rome and create, you know, the High Renaissance Rome. But after that, there's a sort of a hiatus in the art of Italy, because it's almost like, you know, you can't, how can you get better than this, you know? whereas Leonardo lost the competition with Michelangelo. You know, it really was a competition in which there was a winner, and the winner was Michelangelo. Today, we might actually find that hard to understand, because Michelangelo is still very much revered, of course, but Leonardo da Vinci is surely the world's most famous, best-loved artist. You know, people don't write books called The Michelangelo Code, they write books called The Da Vinci Code, and Leonardo is... There are lots of reasons for that. Michelangelo, to appreciate Michelangelo fully, you have to go to Italy for a start. You have to see his sculptures, and, you know, he doesn't work, he's not the same in reproduction, whereas Leonardo, because he did all these notebooks, they can be reproduced quite easily. And even his painting style is better at being reproduced than some other people. But basically, Leonardo is an artist of incredible brilliance, and not just an artist, but a scientist as well, and a thinker and a philosopher. And in the Battle of Anghiari, you know, I think that at this moment, he was actually achieving his perfect blend of science and art, that he was able to put so many of his ideas and thoughts into this work. It was a more personal, philosophical, and stranger work than, you know, say, the Mona Lisa or his famous religious paintings. This was Leonardo's most personal painting, you know, the chance when he got a chance, he actually had the chance to do something on a large scale, as a public work, which really revealed the strange psychological concerns that you see in his notebooks, you know, the nightmares and bizarre imaginative fancies that he liked, that are very much in his notebooks and his drawings. But this is the one chance he got to put it in a painting. And of course, people don't seem to have liked it very much. I think they were shocked and disturbed by this dark, surrealist. The Battle of Anghiari anticipates surrealist art. You know, if you want to compare it with 20th century art, I would compare it with surrealism. In fact, Salvador Dali actually incorporated a copy of it in his painting Spain, which is about the Spanish Civil War. And Picasso, I've already mentioned Guernica. I think, you know, there's an echoes of it in Guernica. And so basically Leonardo was doing really experimental, strange stuff. And he lost the competition because of that. He was seen as weird. Michelangelo was seen as great and as expressing people's beliefs, really, and how they saw the world, how they wanted to see the world, the optimism. It's like the two sides of the Renaissance. I mean, in England, we didn't have any great Renaissance painters, but we had Shakespeare, you know, who I suppose is one of the sort of people who are equal to these titans. And Shakespeare, you know, in Hamlet, Hamlet says, "What a piece of work is a man," you know. That Renaissance idea of the wonder of humanity, the discovery of humanity, that's what the Renaissance is about. And Michelangelo expresses that perfectly. He expresses it in David, and he expressed this as well in this Battle of Castuccia. that he designed. Whereas Leonardo da Vinci in The Battle of Anghiari, he really expresses the other side of Hamlet's speech, and yet to me what is this quintessence of dust, a kind of an underlying fear that perhaps the wonder of humanity is not so wonderful after all. And so you have these two sides that are really arguing about the nature of humanity. Is humanity wonderful or is humanity evil? You know, that kind of argument is going on in their debate, in their conflict.
Again, the name of Jonathan Jones' new book is The Lost Battles, Leonardo, Michelangelo, and the Artistic Duel That Defined the Renaissance. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue.
I've learned to appreciate you the way art lovers do, and I only want to look at you.
Well, since we're talking about important cultural icons, it's only natural that we move on to one who spanned decades of modern culture. Doctor Who. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Debuting in 1963, the iconic science fiction series Doctor Who will turn 50 later this year. Paul Booth, assistant professor of media and cinema studies at DePaul University, explains why the show and the Doctor just keep coming back.
What does it mean to be a fan of something? How is this identity owned, explored, and performed by fans themselves? In my research, I've shown how fans are the future of media audiences. More and more media texts are being created to appeal to fans. At the same time, the devotion that fans feel towards their love text is one of the oldest, most universal feelings. We see it in religious rituals, in imaginative play, in the earliest forms of literature. Fandom unites us and shows us what it means to be human. In particular, I've looked at fans of the BBC television series Doctor Who, which tells the story of an alien who can travel through time and space, bringing with him various earthly assistants as they investigate historical events as well as future societies. The Doctor sees beauty in the foreign and unknown, humor in the face of danger, and truth in the darkest of places. Just like fans. The Doctor Who fans that I have talked with and written about are not the mindless consumers that popular culture might portray them as. Instead, they use Doctor Who as a way to become better people, to communicate and learn from one another. Doctor Who fans write original stories, create clever and powerful videos, and even learn to make clothing in order to share their emotional connection with others. I've used Doctor Who in the classroom as a way to discuss changing cultural norms of morality and ethics. From a fictional program comes immense real-world meaning. Studying fans tells us about human desire and motivation, but it also tells us about the power of emotion and attachment, and the joys we all feel when faced with something we love.
That was Paul Booth of DePaul University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.